If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
Now 7 a.m.
Good morning. A European leader says allies must act as allies after President Trump called Europe weak and decaying. Have European strategies to keep Trump on their side failed? It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News this morning, the United Teachers of Richmond ended their strike. I'm Brian Watt.
The Federal Reserve is expected to lower interest rates today, but there are divisions at the central bank. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Making it easier to borrow money would help the job market. It could also make inflation worse. Senator Ted Cruz called a far-right influencer a Nazi. Why does conservative social media host Brett Cooper say that's a mistake? It is Wednesday, December 10th. On this day in 1906, Theodore Roosevelt became the first American to win a Nobel Prize for negotiating an end to a war between Russia and Japan. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump held a rally last night in central Pennsylvania. He was supposed to talk about the cost of living, but he wandered over many topics. He used foul language to denigrate black immigrants and praised the looks of his cabinet members. NPR's Tamara Keith says Trump did veer back to talking about prices.
Last night, yet again, he mocked the preoccupation with affordability. He says that he inherited a mess. In other words, don't blame me, blame the former guy. And he says things are already cheaper. In particular, he talks a lot about gas prices. According to Gas Buddy, prices are down about 8 cents on average a gallon from a year ago. But that's not really enough savings to make up for higher grocery prices and utility bills and healthcare costs.
NPR's Tamara Keith reporting. The U.S. Supreme Court is hearing arguments today in a case that could have major implications for the death penalty. The justices will consider whether executing people with certain disabilities violates their constitutional rights, as NPR's Kristen Wright explains.
The court struck down the execution of people with intellectual disabilities in 2002. Today, the justices are hearing arguments in an Alabama case that is focused on how intellectual disability is defined and whether IQ should play a role in that determination. Joseph Clifton Smith confessed to a 1997 murder, but he argues his disability should spare his life. But lawyers for the state point to Smith's borderline IQ scores and argue he's not intellectually disabled. Advocates say, though, that determination should be holistic, not a single number. The ruling could have implications on how courts in several states apply the death penalty. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
Billionaire Elon Musk says he thinks his Doge entity that slashed federal jobs was only, quote, a little bit successful. In an interview on the Katie Miller podcast, Musk says he would not lead the Doge project today if he were asked. He says he'd rather work on his companies, such as EV maker Tesla. Stocks opened mixed this morning on Wall Street as investors wait for news on interest rates from the Federal Reserve this afternoon. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 90 points in early trading.
The Fed is widely expected to cut its benchmark interest rate by a quarter point today. The central bank's hoping to cushion a sagging job market, but policymakers are also keeping a watchful eye on inflation. The Labor Department said this morning that private sector wages and salaries rose 3.6% during the 12 months ending in September. During that same period, prices rose by 3%. Stock in Cracker Barrel's down after the restaurant chain reported a drop in sales and lowered its forecast for the year. Cracker Barrel is still trying to recover from an unpopular and short-lived logo change back in August. Pepsi shares are up after the soft drink and snack maker announced plans to cut prices and narrow its product mix. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. The West Contra Costa Unified School District has reached a tentative agreement with its teachers to end a strike that started late last week, affecting tens of thousands of students. The two sides say they reached a deal early this morning. The teachers' union says the agreement includes raises totaling 8% over 2 years, additional wages for special education teachers, hiring bonuses, and stronger health care benefits. The union is calling today an optional classroom prep day for its teachers and says regular classes should return to normal tomorrow. A federal judge in San Jose is set to decide whether to block Trump administration arrests of people attending immigration court hearings and check-in appointments. That's after hearings Tuesday in two related cases. KQED's senior immigration editor Tyke Hendricks reports.
Since May, federal agents have been handcuffing asylum seekers and others in courthouse hallways and ICE check-ins, even those who'd been released to pursue their immigration claims. The government says it's following the law, but advocates say such arrests are unprecedented, arbitrary, and illegal. ACLU attorney Bree Bernwanger is asking U.S. District Judge Casey Pitts to halt the arrests.
Just imagine if the government changed a law and all of a sudden you could be thrown in jail at any time. Imagine how that would harm you. That's how it harms our clients.
Pitt says he will rule as quickly as possible. I'm Tyke Hendricks, KQED News.
Sports, the Sharks lost to the Flyers in Philly, 4-1. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Morning support comes from San Francisco Bay University, offering degree programs in tech and business for a world shaped by AI. sfbu.edu. Support for NPR comes from American Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org, and the listeners and supporters of KQED. Mel, what's going on in San Francisco?
Well, it's on Dolores Street between 17th and 18th Street. There's a one-alarm structure fire. Those are mostly single-family homes. You're being urged to kind of avoid that immediate area just north of Dolores Park. San Francisco 101 southbound off-ramp to Cesar Chavez is partially blocked by a car that is on the shoulder and partially in the lane. The Bay Bridge backup is solid to the maze, but not too bad backing up beyond that. It does remain very sluggish all the way through San Francisco to the 10180 merge. Mel Baker for KQED.
Thanks, Mel. Traffic support from Shen Yun Performing Arts. On KQED News this morning with Brian Watt, next hour, the Oakland Unified School District is facing budget troubles again. The district's board is now expected to vote on major cuts, with a plan calling for potential school closures and mergers. Money and Oakland schools on KQED News. Join us for the story and more at 8:22. Joining us again, more dense fog in Northern California and the Sacramento Valley. Drive carefully if you're out in it again today. Bay Area highs are chilly, mid-40s to the 60s. That's about it. Look for high surf and sneaker waves along the coast. Inland, Sacramento Valley, another day of dense fog and cool temperatures, highs 44 to 51.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Good morning. European officials are saying it is time for President Trump to show them some respect. Their comments are in response to an interview Trump gave to Politico this week, where he called European leaders weak and said their countries are decaying because of immigration. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from London.
Politico began its interview by naming Trump the most influential person shaping Europe.
This year, Politico broke precedent to recognize an American for the first time in history.
And the flattery,
and sir, there is no question that you are having a seismic impact,
yielded a wide-ranging interview in which Trump insulted U.S. allies. He called London Mayor Sadiq Khan, who is of Pakistani descent,
the horrible, vicious, disgusting mayor,
saying Khan owes his election victories to immigrants. European leaders want to be so politically correct, Trump said, drawing this rebuke.
Allies must act as allies.
That's European Council President Antonio Costa. He told reporters in Ireland that Europeans respect how Americans elected Trump and that Trump needs to do the same.
It's like this, that allies behave between each other.
Trump called Russia strong because of its size, Biden-era aid to Ukraine stupid, and European leaders weak. In a speech, British Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper said it's the opposite.
I see in Europe is strength, and the strength and commitment to support Ukraine.
Europe is contributing more to Ukraine's defense as Trump withdraws European security guarantees that have been here since World War II. The White House recently published a document predicting civilizational erasure in Europe, which was praised by the Kremlin. Here in London, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has generally avoided criticizing Trump. They signed an early trade deal exempting Britain from some U.S. tariffs. The strategy here has been to keep Trump close.
I think, to be honest, the time has come to realize that that strategy has failed.
Natalie Tocci, a former European Union advisor, spoke to the BBC.
Europe is alone. And the sooner we come to terms with this reality, the less the damage will be.
For Europe, she says it's now about mitigating damage from the U.S. once its closest ally. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
For more on President Trump's relationship with Europe, we're joined by Anne Applebaum. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and historian, a staff writer for The Atlantic, who's reported from all over the world, and she's with us now. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning.
So what stood out to you in the president's remarks about Europe?
I think what stands out about the national security strategy is that Trump has given up on identifying America's rivals as Russia and China. He's given up on the idea that we play a role in the world to protect democracy, to spread freedom, even to increase prosperity of Americans by arguing for open trade. And instead, he has decided on a policy of undermining and disparaging allies. And I think that's going to prove very dangerous in the long term.
So Trump has criticized Europe before, I mean, in both of his administrations, mainly about what he said was inadequate military spending. How is this different?
Well, first of all, it's different because Europe is spending on the military. And not only that, Europe is now the main supporter, almost sole supporter of the Ukrainians. I mean, all the weapons and money going into Ukraine this year have come from Europe. So that's not a criticism you can make anymore. Civilizational erasure is more of it's a far right idea. I mean, it's actually way to the right of most European far right parties. It's an idea that Europe is somehow fundamentally intellectually and emotionally and physically flawed and won't survive. And that's an existential attack that you can't fix by, you know, spending more on weapons or by having a better diplomatic relationship or by flattering the president. Trump has clearly got this impression from some of the people around him, some of whom believe this or have been promoting these ideas for domestic reasons as part of a domestic debate in the United States for a long time. And of course, it grotesquely misreads what Europe is. It misunderstands even immigration. It misunderstands that, you know, European countries are, on any list you look at, have the highest living standards, are the safest places to live, have the highest education, have the best environmental policies. I mean, this is a very attractive and powerful part of the world. And if the United States is now going to set itself against it and try to tear it apart, as I said, that will eventually have terrible results for the United States.
So on Monday, my colleague Layla spoke with Alexandra de Hoop Scheffer, the president of the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Let's listen to what she had to say.
What you are seeing live today is a new transatlantic bargain where Europeans are accepting and integrating the idea that the transatlantic relationship is going to be more transactional, more conditional.
It sounds to me like she's saying that the president just finally said the quiet part out loud and that Europe has seen this coming and is already kind of adapting to this idea. Do you think that that's accurate?
If the relationship is going to be more transactional, that's maybe the best possible outcome. But the NSS that was written implies that the U.S. will be actively seeking to dismantle European institutions and will be playing a role inside European politics, inside the domestic politics of European countries, which is in a contradictory way is exactly the opposite of what it said it would be doing in the autocratic world, especially in the Middle East. And that would be, as I said, that will backfire.
Yes, exactly. That's what I also want to ask you. How do you think Europe's going to respond to this if that is, in fact, the case?
It will be a very negative response. And, of course, that response is happening now. I mean, I didn't know that people are going to say it in public, but a very wide range of European leaders, including many on the right, will be distressed by this. European Union means a lot to the economies of Europe. The idea that the U.S. would play a role in breaking it up will be perceived very negatively. And of course, that will have consequences for Europe's willingness to help the U.S. in other situations and in other spheres.
What do you think this perspective that's outlined in this national security strategy and in the president's remarks, what does this mean for Ukraine?
I mean, it's not good for Ukraine because it seems to favor Russia. So almost everything in the document reflects Russian strategy. The Russians also talk about a decline in Europe. They also want to break up the EU. They also seek to downplay the role of the U.S. in Europe. They also want to break up America and Europe. And so, unfortunately, this document is very good for Russia.
Before we let you go, we only have 20 seconds here. Are you surprised by any of this?
No, I'm not entirely surprised. I mean, this is language that's been kicking around in the American far right for many years, and I heard it before the election, and I'm not surprised to hear it now.
That's Ann Applebaum. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic and a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. Ann Applebaum, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Nobel Peace Prize was presented this morning in Oslo, Norway, to Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado. The Nobel Committee cited her, quote, long-standing struggle to achieve a just and peaceful transition from dictatorship to democracy, a South American nation. But Machado, who has been in hiding inside Venezuela to avoid being arrested by the country's authoritarian regime, was unable to make it to Oslo on time for the ceremony. So her daughter, Anna, accepted the prize on her behalf.
I am here on behalf of my mother, Maria Corina Machado, who has united millions of Venezuelans in an extraordinary effort that you, our hosts, have honored with a Nobel Peace Prize.
Reporter John Otis has been covering Venezuela for us from neighboring Colombia. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Leila.
So, John, despite the danger she faces, Maria Corina Machado had vowed to attend today's ceremony. What happened?
It's really been a mystery. Rumors flying all over the place about her whereabouts. Oslo is packed with journalists. Much of Machado's family made the trip to Norway. Several Latin American presidents are there. Even Machado's dress for the ceremony was apparently waiting for her. But the first sign of trouble came on Tuesday when Machado failed to show up for a news conference. Her press aides didn't seem to know where she was, what was going on. And remember, Machado faces a travel ban in Venezuela, so getting out of the country without getting arrested is tricky. Finally, she managed this phone call this morning with the chair of the Nobel Institute to say she was safe and on her way to Oslo. Let's take a listen.
Hi, Jorgen.
Is it Maria Corina?
Yes, this is Maria.
First, I just want to say we're so happy to hear your voice. We're so happy to hear that you're safe.
Me too.
Maria Corina Machado went on to say that getting out of Venezuela involved, quote, extreme danger in which many people risked their lives.
And how did all this affect the ceremony?
Machado's daughter, Anna, accepted the Nobel Diploma and Gold Medal on her mother's behalf. And the drama surrounding Machado's quest to get out of Venezuela and get to Oslo may have actually added some urgency to her message that Venezuela needs regime change. Machado tried to bring that about in last year's presidential election. Although she was banned from running in that race, she helped convince millions of Venezuelans to vote for her stand-in candidate, Edmundo González. According to voter tally sheets, González trounced President Nicolás Maduro. But Maduro has refused to give up power, and Machado went into hiding, and it seemed like nothing was going to change. But her winning the Nobel plus President Trump's military buildup in the Caribbean Sea and his vows that Maduro's days are numbered have suddenly thrust Venezuela back into the news.
Now, Machado is openly lobbying for the U.S. military to depose Maduro, and that has brought out some critics of her receiving the Nobel Peace Prize, right?
Yeah, that's true. And in fact, there were some small protests in Oslo of people who believe that she's too bellicose to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. But Machado argues that she did push for a peaceful transition to democracy through last year's election. She played by the rules. But Maduro refused to give up power, and he used his armed forces to crush anti-government protests. So from Machado's point of view, a military action to oust Maduro may be the only option that's left to create a more democratic and peaceful Venezuela.
That's John Otis reporting from Bogota, Colombia. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
On listener-supported KQED, I'm Dave Freeman. Wednesday morning, 7:19 is the time. That means traffic time once again. Traffic and transit as Mel takes a look at Caltrain.
Train number 503 heading northbound is running about 15 minutes late. Unclear if other trains are being affected by that delay. Meanwhile, major delays on ACE train all morning. Train number 1 had been delayed earlier. Now train number 3 is running 30 minutes late between Stockton and San Jose. The backup on the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge is now really solid from Cutting Boulevard to the Maze. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic and transit support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Picture House, presenting The Tale of Cillian, a story of resilience and a powerful connection between a down-on-his-luck farmer and a wounded white stork, at the Roxy December 12th. Cal Privacy, enforcing privacy regulations and protecting consumer rights. Californians can take control of their personal information by opting out of selling and sharing it with businesses. More information at privacy.ca.gov. Coming up on KQED and Morning Edition, a third of the people ICE arrested in the first 9 months of President Trump's second term had no criminal record, data shows. Layla Fadel talks to the Migration Policy Institute's Ariel Ruiz Soto. Coming up next.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. Next time on Forum, the National Institutes of Health have historically funded scientists to find cures for diseases and protect public health. After a year of funding cuts and freezes that have rocked the medical research field to its core, we're going to catch up with leading researchers locally to talk about the impact this has had on their work and our ability to fight humanity's most puzzling illnesses. That's at 9 a.m. right here on KQED.
And looking ahead to Forum at 10 with Mina Kim, a discussion about the impact and legality of U.S. strikes on suspected drug smugglers. 9 to 11, it's Forum. Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. Subaru, the Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. And Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor, can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And by the listeners and sustaining members of KQED. Now 722.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. President Trump has repeatedly said that in enforcing immigration policy, he would deport criminals, rapists, and the worst of the worst. But new data reveals that in the first 9 months of the president's second term, Immigration and Customs Enforcement arrested more than 74,000 people with no criminal record. That's more than a third of the total ICE arrests in that period. Those numbers were provided by ICE to the Deportation Data Project, a joint initiative of UCLA and UC Berkeley Law, and analyzed by NPR. For more, I spoke to Ariel Ruiz Soto, a senior policy analyst with the Migration Policy Institute, and I started by asking him what this says about the Trump administration's approach to immigration enforcement.
Well, at first it contradicts the earlier messaging from the Trump administration that is focused on the worst of the worst and targeting criminal convictions. However, recently the administration has also said that anybody here in the United States without legal status will be subject to deportation in the future.
Well, let's get to what is a crime and what's not. We hear from the administration, not just the claims that they're arresting rapists and gang members, but also they say that anyone in the country without proper paperwork is a criminal. Is that true, that being undocumented means you've committed a crime?
Under immigration law, entering the country without proper authorization is a lower offense compared to those that we colloquially think are criminal convictions in a more criminal system, meaning, for example, murder, rape, drug abuse, or something else like that, that could get it to be higher.
What do we know about the other two-thirds of these arrests? Do they all have criminal histories?
No. Among the other two-thirds, about half of those are actually people with a criminal pending charge but not yet proven guilty. Of those that do have a criminal conviction, we know from previous reports from ICE and experience that we've done research on that the majority of those criminal convictions tend to be traffic violations or lower-level offenses.
Was that surprising to you?
I didn't think it was surprising because it's been happening over months. I think that the visibility has been surprising. And perhaps the other aspect of this that has been also not transparent is this is just for ICE arrests. We don't know yet how many arrests are being made by Border Patrol across the different cities they're now targeting to consider the full impact of this new enforcement.
What has this meant for immigrant communities, mixed status communities and families when it comes to their presence in the United States and their relationship with law enforcement and the government?
Well, the direct impact is on those people that are here without status. Many of them are not going outside of their homes. But I think the bigger impact here is that mixed status families are also affected. The fact, for example, that families may forego seeking benefits that are eligible for their U.S. citizen children because they're afraid of potentially being detained or arrested, that actually has implications for U.S. citizens. And many of these citizens, in fact, 5.3 million U.S. citizen children have one parent who is undocumented in the United States, and that could actually make a significant difference in their separation.
What would you say to people listening who say, well, I mean, people should not have entered without status, and this is the consequence?
Well, it's clear that migrants who are here without status are subject to deportation and arrest, but people have access to due process. They need to have an opportunity to present their claims to why they should stay in the United States. And if in the end of that litigation, it is determined that the person has to leave the United States, and that should be the case.
Ariel Ruiz Soto is a senior policy analyst with the Migration Policy Institute. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We reached out to ICE for comment and have not heard back.
Fighting in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo is the heaviest it's been for months. That's even after President Trump declared the conflict over. Emmett Livingstone reports, and a warning, you will hear gunfire in this piece.
Only last week, President Trump hailed a historic moment, bringing the leaders of Congo and Rwanda to Washington for a ceremony meant to end years of conflict.
It is an amazing day. Great day for Africa, great day for the world, and for these two countries, and they have so much to be proud of.
But the razor-sharp tensions between Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi and Rwanda's President Paul Kagame were clear. As the audience applauded, the two leaders avoided each other's eyes and didn't shake hands. But even while the speeches were being made, violent clashes with Rwanda-backed M23 rebels and the Congolese army continued in a conflict that has its roots in the Rwandan genocide over three decades ago.
Malgré notre bonne foi,
by Monday, back in the capital, Kinshasa, Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi was already warning that the peace deal was in jeopardy. In an address to the nation, he said, despite our good faith, Rwanda is already violating its commitments. Rwanda says it doesn't back the M23, but the US, the UN and others disagree. Earlier this year, the rebels took Goma and Bukavu, eastern Congo's largest cities. They began to progress south last week, and by Tuesday, the rebels were closing in on Uvira, a key city on the Burundi border. By nightfall, it had fallen. Thousands have been killed in the conflict over the years, and the UN reports that more than 200,000 people have fled the area this month alone. Now the rebels are one step closer to Congo's Katanga region, which is rich in copper and cobalt. The Trump administration has signed an economic deal with Congo meant to encourage US companies to invest in that region. But the peace deal between Congo and Rwanda is falling apart, and talks with the M23 rebels have stalled. For NPR News, I'm Emmett Livingstone in Kinshasa.
This morning, we mourn and remember our colleague Kevin Drew, who spent many years keeping us informed and up to speed on everything happening around the world. Kevin was NPR's overnight supervising editor and was the man that took our urgent calls in the middle of the night. This weekend, he passed away of esophageal cancer. He worked with the Associated Press, CNN, The New York Times, and us here at NPR. His siblings told us that he lived, as he reported, with passion for people and a caring heart. Over his career, he taught journalism and was a member of teams whose work won DuPont Columbia and Peabody Awards. Kevin Drew will be missed. His contributions to NPR, journalism, and public service live on. This is NPR News.
It's KQED 729. Traffic now with Mel.
In Vacaville, 80 westbound before about Mason Street, an accident blocking the right lane with a vehicle on its side. Traffic is stop and go back to Allison. Highway 37, it's the usual bunch up between the Bridge and the Lane merge, and then it is slow out to about Skaggs Island Road, where there is a crash reported. We don't have any lane details. Meanwhile, let me make a correction on the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge. The backup is between Cutting Boulevard and the Toll Plaza. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from Netflix presenting Apocalypse in the Tropics. The documentary by Petra Costa investigates the fast rise of the evangelical movement in Brazil and the consequences for politics and democracy. Now on Netflix, awards eligible. John Muir Health, offering comprehensive cancer care with a team approach and advanced treatment options at the UCSF John Muir Health Gene and Ken Hoffman Cancer Center in Walnut Creek. It's 7:30.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. A deal has been reached to end the strike by West Contra Costa school teachers. The district and the teachers' union say they reached a tentative agreement this morning that includes a salary and health care increase, among other things. Their bargaining session ended at 2 a.m. District officials say schools will remain open today and that classes will return to normal tomorrow. The deal now goes to the members of the United Teachers of Richmond and the district board for ratification. The strike, which began last Thursday, was the first ever by the teachers' union. A federal judge in San Francisco is ordering the Trump administration to end its current deployment of California National Guard troops in Los Angeles. Judge Charles Breyer, in a ruling issued this morning, says the administration illegally kept Guard soldiers in L.A. long after street protests over immigration raids ended over the summer. The ruling applies to about 100 National Guard troops who are still in Los Angeles. Judge Breyer has directed the administration to return control of the troops to Governor Newsom, but he stayed his order until Monday with an expected appeal. We're learning more about communication problems that delayed the response to a massive refinery fire in Martinez in February. KQED's Julie Small reports.
When the fire at the Martinez Refining Company erupted February 2nd, the refinery's in-house brigade acted quickly, but they forgot to use the radio system shared by multiple city and county responders. Contra Costa County Deputy Fire Chief Aaron McAllister.
It delayed our ability to get immediate intelligence as to what's burning, what's involved in fire, what the product is, what are the firefighting efforts underway.
McAllister thinks more joint training could help prevent such lapses in the future. Neighbors had to shelter in place while the fire burned. And Heidi Taylor, an activist with Healthy Martinez, says it's disappointing to learn communications issues played a part.
To think that, you know, that the agencies were not coordinating and that decisions were delayed as a result, that just makes me sick.
Taylor says residents also distrusted information coming from the refining company during the incident and would have trusted the work of local officials or public safety agencies more. No one was injured in the incident, but the refinery was shut down for more than 2 months, contributing to a spike in gas prices. I'm Julie Small, KQED News.
Recent changes to California's landmark climate program, known as Cap and Invest, could bring mixed results for consumer affordability, according to a new report from the state's legislative analyst. KQED politics correspondent Guy Marzorati has more.
Under Cap and Invest, refineries and factories have to pay for the ability to pollute in California. Changes approved by Governor Gavin Newsom and the legislature this fall put a stricter cap on carbon emissions to help the state meet its greenhouse gas reduction goals. The legislative analyst report says that could drive up the price of carbon, which could result in higher gas prices. But the report finds other changes to the program could help affordability, like an increase to the credit that Californians receive on their electric bills. I'm Guy Marzorati, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. More at KQED.org.
Support comes from Oakland, San Francisco Bay Airport, Beauty, Pride, Love. Learn more at iFlyOAK.com. For the Bay today, areas of dense morning fog, high temperatures mid-40s to the 60s. Along the coast, high surf and sneaker waves. Chance of rain possible Monday. Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay in theaters this Friday. Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor, can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And by the listeners and sustaining members of KQED.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The Federal Reserve is expected to cut interest rates today, but the path to that decision could be bumpy.
Yeah, the central bank is trying to keep a lid on both inflation and unemployment. And members of the Fed's rate-setting committee are divided over which of those goals is more urgent.
NPR's Scott Horsley is with us now to tell us more about this. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
So why do forecasters expect a rate cut today?
We have seen a real slowdown in the job market in recent months, and a number of Fed policymakers are very concerned about that. Over the summer, we saw a net loss of jobs in both June and August. The unemployment rate has been inching up. Fed Governor Chris Waller has been saying for months now the warning signs are flashing on the job market, and the central bank should lower interest rates to prevent a further deterioration.
The labor market is still weak and near stall speed.
The Fed already cut its benchmark interest rate in September and October, and a third cut would make it a little bit cheaper to borrow money, so consumers might spend a bit more, and businesses, in turn, might need to hire more people.
So that's the argument for cutting rates, but it sounds like it's not a slam dunk.
It's not, because we've still got the specter of inflation out there. That's the other part of the Fed's job, and some policymakers think getting prices under control is a bigger concern right now than the softening job market. Prices are still climbing faster than the Fed would like. Just yesterday, we got some survey data showing that a lot of small businesses are raising prices. There's concern that the president's tariffs will continue to push prices up in the new year. Susan Collins, who heads the Boston Federal Reserve Bank, voted for rate cuts in both September and October, but she says the bar is pretty high before she would vote for a third cut this week.
Absent evidence of a notable labor market deterioration, I'd be hesitant to ease policy further, especially given the limited information on inflation due to the government shutdown.
Because of that six-week shutdown, we don't know what the unemployment rate was in October, and we don't know what the inflation rate was that month, because the federal workers who were furloughed were unable to gather that data. What's more, the numbers for November, which the Fed would ordinarily have in its hands at this meeting, won't come out until next week. So policymakers are at a bit of a handicap here as they try to steer the economy through thicker-than-usual fog.
How unusual is it to have this much division on the rate-setting committee?
You know, the Fed likes to operate by consensus. It's not uncommon to have some disagreement, but it is unusual to have a lot, and in particular to have disagreement in both directions. At the last Fed meeting, we had two dissents, one from a committee member who thought the Fed was cutting rates too aggressively, and another who thought the Fed wasn't moving fast enough. It's been 6 years since there were three dissents on a Fed vote, and it's been 33 years since there were four dissents. It's possible we could see that many today.
And before we let you go, should we look for more rate cuts in the future?
President Trump is certainly calling for more, but we'll see. You know, Fed officials will update their forecast today of where they think interest rates are likely to go next year. Back in September, the average Fed policymaker was projecting only one quarter point rate cut in 2026. We'll see if that outlook has changed at all. Right now, investors think there is a better than even chance that we could see more rate cuts next year.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
In 3 weeks, federal subsidies that make it less expensive for people to buy health insurance through the Affordable Care Act will expire. Congress is scheduled to vote on a proposal from Democrats to extend those subsidies this week, but it's not expected to pass. While Congress debates what policy could come next, Colorado and a few other states are trying to keep health care costs in check themselves. Here's John Daly of Colorado Public Radio.
Chelsea Baker Houck has a lot on her plate.
Well, today I am hooked up to an IV all day and all day yesterday getting my immunoglobulin infusion.
She spoke to me from a medical clinic in Denver. She's been battling long COVID, a heart condition, and an autoimmune disease that requires treatment every 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'm a lifer.
One stressor she didn't need is uncertainty about her health coverage. Baker Hauck runs a consulting business and gets the enhanced federal tax credit to help pay for the insurance she buys through Colorado's marketplace. Last year, she paid $239 a month after getting a $313 tax credit. If Congress does not renew the subsidies, the cost of the insurance she's now shopping for is set to rise sharply.
It's a lot more, yeah. It's a lot more. It's more than twice what I was paying last year.
In anticipation, Colorado took steps to help protect coverage for those like Baker Hauck.
Today, members, we're here to proudly present House Bill 25B-1006.
Lawmakers met in a special session over the summer called by Governor Jared Polis. The Democratic majority introduced legislation. It aims to blunt the impact of the loss of the federal subsidies. Here's co-sponsor Lindsey Gilchrist.
This bill will provide $100 million to prevent, as best we can, the massive cost increases Coloradans will otherwise face.
It paved the way for a $100 million interest-free loan from a trust fund of unclaimed property to help reduce premium costs for consumers. Democrats passed it over the objections of Republicans, like Representative Dusty Johnson, who didn't like the way the state would pay for it.
We are passing the buck by robbing Peter or robbing the people of Colorado because this is their dollars, not government dollars. This is the people's dollars that they have the right to claim back.
But state leaders say if the enhanced tax credits aren't renewed, it'll be a disaster for the state's health system and will drive more people to become uninsured. Colorado is not the only state to take action, says Matt McGough, a policy analyst with KFF, an independent health policy group.
States are just trying to fill in where they can.
Democratic-led states, some with strong state marketplaces like California, Maryland, and Massachusetts, have also tried to help their residents. They're offering state-funded premium assistance like Colorado, or leaning on state programs that help soften the blow for insurance companies dealing with high-cost claims. Or, McGough says, they're ramping up consumer outreach.
But everything that they're doing is a drop in the bucket of what the federal government has done and is rolling back this year.
And none of these state efforts are permanent, he says.
From my understanding, a lot of these are just emergency measures, one-time fixes that provide a gentle landing.
Insurance customer Chelsea Baker Hauck says she's grateful to state leaders for the help, which would save her $80 a month.
This is a step in the right direction. I mean, $80 is a lot for me right now, so that adds up.
Meanwhile, she's already cutting back on spending to cope with the much higher health insurance costs she fears.
One of the things I've been doing is stopping medications, especially the ones that I have to pay out of pocket for.
Baker Hauck says it's unfortunate, but for now, she doesn't have a choice. For NPR News, I'm John Daly in Denver.
This is NPR News.
And here in Northern California on KQED, we have Bay Area traffic with Mel Baker starting in the North Bay.
Yeah, checking our dense fog advisory for Sonoma County. I'm looking at the cameras. It doesn't look as bad as it was earlier this morning, but watch out for pockets of fog. 101 northbound and southbound from Santa Rosa between Yolanda Avenue and College Avenue. Be prepared for a little slow traffic. It becomes much heavier in Nevada, 101 southbound between Roland Boulevard and North San Pedro Road. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Glime the Jeweler. Support for KQED comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. Have you had breakfast yet? Before its fall from grace, the Chinese-American dish chop suey was a holiday tradition for families who don't celebrate Christmas, even being immortalized in songs and film. The story ahead on Morning Edition right here on KQED News this morning.
Hey, I'm Ryan Davis, head of live events at KQED.
It's our winter season, so it's time to get cozy and connect with others over some delicious food. Each of these events is going to feature a comfort food staple and give you a chance to learn more about the culture behind it and to taste some great samples. There's nothing that builds stronger community bonds than breaking bread together. Check them out at kqed.org/events.
Next on the California Report, California used to build condos as an affordable path to home ownership. Now, they're nearly vanished, and a growing group of housing advocates say state laws are partly to blame. I'm Adi Bolaños. We dig into what happened and what it would take to bring condos back on the next California Report.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. President Trump rallies voters in Pennsylvania to talk up the economy, but can he address people's concerns about the persistently high cost of living in the U.S.? We'll fact-check the president's economic claims and assess how the economy is doing next time on Here and Now.
Coming up at 11 today, support for NPR comes from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more. MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And by the listeners and generous sustaining members of KQED. Good morning. On Wednesday, I'm Dave Freeman. The time coming right up on 7:46.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The Chinese-American dish chop suey is a holiday classic.
Chop suey! Chop suey!
This Broadway show tune dates back to the 1950s when chop suey was a more common menu item. Eventually, it became a Chinese restaurant staple for Jewish people and others who don't celebrate Christmas if they dined out on Christmas Day when many other restaurants closed. NPR's Netta Ulibi has more.
What is smelling so amazing in the kitchen of Miranda Brown?
Bell peppers cooking with some garlic.
Brown is a professor of Chinese history at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. She became interested in the history of chop suey a few years ago and offered to make it.
It's a dish that is chopped awful.
Awful. The gutsy stuff. O-F-F-A-L. For many years in this country, we've thought of chop suey as a mishmash of stir-fried ingredients, Brown says. But what first made chop suey was organ meat.
Lung, liver, tripe, kidneys.
Rich in flavor and nutrients, offal was once more commonly enjoyed than it is today. As she stirs livers into the bubbling wok on her stove, Brown says the texture of offal is at least, for some, part of its appeal.
It can be chewy, buttery, rubbery. For some people, that's really kind of exciting, bouncy.
And this dish bounces back in history much further, she says, than you might expect.
We have references to chop suey, zasui in Mandarin, in Ming Dynasty texts. So The Journey to the West, which is a famous novel, has a reference to chop suey, zasui.
That novel from 400 years ago is still adapted into TV shows and movies in China, like one from 2013, where a character enjoys a lavish banquet. In real life, Brown says, chop suey was part of ceremonial meals in Imperial China.
And so you will find it on fancy banquet menus. A version of the dish was even eaten at the Qing court.
When Chinese immigrants to the U.S. in the 1800s wanted to build relationships with local officials, Brown says, they held similar banquets, 300-course meals that would be written up in newspapers. Peking duck, bird's nest soup, chop suey.
All the bling foods that were popular when you had to make a good relationship with a person who had a lot of say about your life.
Although the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 heavily restricted immigration, Chinese restaurants spread rapidly across the United States. Chop suey became a favorite. In 1926, Louis Armstrong recorded a song called Cornet Chop Suey. The dish became a beloved ambassador to what had been to many an unfamiliar cuisine.
It was exotic, involved a little bit of adventure, and it is a name that people can pronounce.
In the movie A Christmas Story, set in the 1940s, a white working-class family celebrates Christmas at a Chinese restaurant in Indiana. Its sign says Chop Suey Palace. But within decades, Brown says,
it fell from grace, you know, in a very big way. I grew up in San Francisco and never encountered it on a menu in the 80s.
By then, chop suey was widely seen as inauthentic, no longer the tempting organ meat melange that had once impressed aristocracy.
Professor Miranda Brown cooks from her own mixed heritage, half white and half Chinese. Chop suey, she says, reflects a people's resilience and adaptation.
Foods evolve. I mean, I always think, like, if I met my great-great-grandparents, would they recognize me? Would they see elements of their faces in mine? And I would guess not.
Something similar happened with Chinese food in America, she says.
When a dish leaves, 100 years later, it has evolved a lot.
Miranda Brown thinks it's time for Chop Suey's next evolution in the form of a comeback. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
KQED traffic is next with Mel Baker taking us to Pittsburgh.
Highway 4 westbound before Bailey Road. The left lane is blocked by hit-and-run crash. Traffic is nearly at a stop back to Harbor Street. In Vacaville, 80 westbound before Mason Street. The three right lanes are now blocked by a crash there, including a car on its side. Traffic is pretty much stopped back to 505 at this point. Mel Baker, 4KQED.
Wednesday morning, traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Marketplace Morning Report ahead, 7:51. Coming up, Texas has launched the first state-run cryptocurrency reserve. Get a closer look at why Texas is embracing cryptocurrency. And thinking of refinancing your home this year? Hear about how to protect yourself against shady refinancing offers. All ahead at 7:51.
Trade, climate, security. To understand major international issues, you need a global perspective. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Deepen your understanding. Listen to the world every weekday.
Global News at 2, the news at 3, too.
I'm Jeff Bennett. On the next NewsHour, the Federal Reserve decides on another interest rate cut amid mixed economic data. That's Wednesday on the PBS NewsHour.
A donor-advised fund is one of the most tax-efficient ways to give. Maximize your charitable impact by recommending a grant to KQED to support the public media you and your community rely on. Learn more at kqed.org/DAF. Thank you so much. And more of the Thule fog and stratus for the North and East Bay and the Sacramento Valleys, according to the Weather Service today. Trying to get some sunshine later today. We'll be hazy in parts of the Bay Area. Hazy sun also forecast for the Sacramento Valley. Look for highs today in the 40s to the 60s around the Bay.
Our no free lunch warning of the week. This time it's about home loan refinancing.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Yubico, makers of the YubiKey. YubiKey helps protect important digital applications and services. YubiKey, still undefeated, the original passkey. More at yubico.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. First, Texas has launched the first state-run cryptocurrency reserve with a $5 million purchase of Bitcoin. Texas has also been very welcoming to electricity-intensive data centers that create new cryptocurrency. These Bitcoin miners and other states are looking to add crypto to their state coffers as well. Marketplace's Nova Safo has more.
Texas welcomed crypto mining after China banned it in 2021. And by one count, at least 60 power-hungry crypto mines, essentially computer clusters running 24/7, are now operating in the state.
Texas has had a tremendously open grid situation with plenty of electricity.
That's Ed Herz, an energy fellow at the University of Houston's Department of Economics. And while a $5 million Bitcoin reserve is not much, Lee Bratcher of the crypto industry trade group Texas Blockchain Council says it matters for the companies that now call the state home.
It does send a powerful signal that Texas is going to be and continues to be a pro-business state that's open for innovation. Texas is making a play to be where the future of finance and capital formation happen.
But Hillary Allen of American University says the signal Texas is really sending is that there are governments willing to back cryptocurrencies, which can have wildly fluctuating prices.
I think, you know, this is something that the crypto industry wants because they want to have this baseline demand to sort of keep the floor from falling out completely under these crypto assets.
Some Texas lawmakers say a crypto reserve can be a good investment because the state can sell assets later for a profit. And other state governments may soon follow suit. Arizona and New Hampshire have enacted laws to create similar crypto funds. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
And here's a vivid set of numbers, starting with -27%. That's the drop in federal prosecutions of alleged tax cheats in America this year. These figures today were calculated by the news agency Reuters from counting court dockets. This with IRS staffing down 10% in the first half of the year, 1,000 lawyers gone from the U.S. Attorney's Office, and some IRS agents doing immigration patrols instead of tax work.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Fidelity Investments. A dedicated advisor can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And by Progressive Insurance. Customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto. Learn more about bundling at progressive.com.
In just over 3 hours now, we'll get confirmation from the Federal Reserve about what is very likely a small 0.25 percentage point drop in a short-term interest rate to perhaps pump some more energy into an economy with weak spots. But don't think that translates to lower home loan rates necessarily. A sense among bond market participants that we might get fewer rate cuts from central bankers in 2026 is driving down 30-year bonds today, which could push up mortgage rates. This is just one reason. If you get a phone call offering mortgage refinancing with no cost to you, beware. Let's get more from Jacob Faber, an associate professor of sociology and public service at New York University. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
One of our reporters shared this story the other day. Her mom received a call from a lender promising her that with lower mortgage rates, she could reduce her monthly mortgage payment and it wasn't going to cost her anything. But sure enough, the mother's now on the hook for the fees associated with refinancing and new terms for the loan. Are you seeing the likes of this out there?
Absolutely. We are hearing a lot of kind of reports of calls like this. You know, it's important to distinguish between kind of outright scams where people are being lied to by someone claiming to be an underwriter or, you know, mortgage rescuer, but that person doesn't actually represent your lender. And, you know, real offers from lenders that sound great, but don't end up benefiting the borrower in the end.
I mean, if it's fraud, it's fraud, but wrapping the cost into a refinancing package is legal. I mean, it's what you would expect at some level.
That's true. That doesn't mean that it's good for the borrower. So it can be difficult to understand how a homeowner can balance short-term cost of refinancing against, you know, medium and long-term savings of a lower interest rate. And it's always important to remember that your lender's primary incentive is to make profit and not necessarily make the best decision for your specific circumstance. You know, there's never a free lunch. And, you know, speaking as someone who has been studying the mortgage industry for well over a decade, and buying a home this past summer, it still was hard for me to understand all of the things that were going on and were being offered to me in that instance.
What are some of the warning signs that you look out for when trying to negotiate a complex deal like this?
You know, anything that sounds strange or too good to be true, this is going to cost nothing, is a pretty big flag. People being asked to pay fees up front or, you know, cancel their mortgage payments or send them to someone other than who they've been sending them to. And anyone who's being too aggressive, you know, putting pressure on you to agree to something or asserting that something will definitely guarantee a financial return. These are all things we should be worried about.
If you're sitting there alone trying to make a huge money decision like this, it might behoove you to get some expert opinion or some other family opinion or to talk to at least one other person before agreeing to something.
I'll also say that Google search will lead you to many useful resources that are provided by, you know, state level governments. There's plenty of advice available for how to avoid these types of scams and how to make the calculation of whether or not refinancing at any particular time is worth it.
Jacob Faber teaches at New York University. Thank you so much for the time.
Have a good one.
Checking markets, the Dow is up 120 points, 0.3%, but the S&P is down 0.1%. I see the NASDAQ is down 0.5% as we look for signs. America's central bankers might be leaning toward fewer interest rate cuts in the new year, something bond market players had been fretting about this week, but less so as this morning wears on. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. This is the Marketplace Morning Report from APM. American Public Media.
Indeed, the morning wears on. More Morning Edition ahead in a minute along with KQED News. Mel has the traffic news now in Dublin.
Eastbound 580 at the Dublin interchange. The left lane is blocked. Traffic is slow from Foothill Road due to a two-car crash. In the Altamont Pass of 205 westbound, backed up all the way to 11th Street. A little sluggish on 580 from 132 on the Tracy side up to the 580-205 interchange. And then 580 itself is stop and go out to Grant Line. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Glime, the jeweler. Support for KQED comes from El Camino Health. Open enrollment happens once a year. More about which health plans provide access to El Camino Health doctors and nationally recognized hospitals at elcaminohealth.org/open enrollment. Good morning. I'm Dave.